You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, stress compounded by a pandemic, a heated election campaign, and social unrest around race is impacting a lot of people. According to a new study result released by the American Psychological Association, we'll talk about how to help manage things. First, as voting draws to a close next Tuesday, there's an important deadline today for absentee voting. Nora Eckert is a reporter for VoteBeat, working with Wisconsin Watch. She joins us now with a look at last-minute ways to make sure your absentee ballot gets counted. Nora, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Nora, if people voted early by mailing in a ballot or dropping it off, how can they find out if it got where it needed to go and has been accepted?
Yeah, there's a very easy tracking tool online. So you can easily do that by Googling myvote.wi.gov. And you can enter your date of birth in there and your first and last name. And your ballot progress will be clearly displayed on the screen.
Now, what if we see bad news? It was rejected for some reason, or in some cases, clerks will actually call us. What do we do?
Yes, at this point, you'll likely know your clerk will have probably identified you if you have an error with your ballot. And we found out that about 1,400 people were in that situation just about a week ago. So you have a few options right now. The main thing we want to make clear is don't try to mail it back at this point. We're running short on time, just 5 days from Election Day. So you don't want to put it in the mail. You can drop it off at a drop box. Or you can also come into your clerk's office and correct that with them. But as we get closer to Election Day, those in-person options are the safest in terms of getting your ballot counted.
So if we get that bit of bad news, what is the deadline to make that change?
So there's an important deadline today, and that is if you want to cancel your ballot. So that's different than fixing it. You have to do that today. So that would be if you've decided to change your vote, or if you've mailed in your ballot absentee and have decided, actually, I want to vote in person. You have to call your clerk today to cancel your ballot so you can cast your ballot in person. And that absentee vote that you send in the mail, if you cancel it, that won't count, and your in-person vote will.
Now, what if we have that that ballot that says for whatever reason we didn't sign in the right place or whatever, it's been rejected, we want to fix it? What's the timeline to do that?
You actually have up until Election Day. So the big thing is you don't want to send that in the mail yet. So say you've got this ballot sitting at home that's been flagged as having an error. You can do a few things. You can correct that, turn it in with your clerk, or you can even bring it in on Election Day. And the election officials on Election Day will either accept that ballot or spoil that ballot and issue a new one, which you can fill out correctly.
Now, if I've ordered a ballot, never filled it out, decided I really want to do it in person on Election Day, after all, am I going to get in trouble having requested a ballot and then trying to vote in person?
No, there are systems in place to ensure that there are not two ballots counted. So as long as you haven't mailed that ballot back in, you're safe to go and vote in person on Election Day.
So I don't have to unrequest that current absentee ballot.
Yep, that's correct. You do not have to unrequest it.
And Nora, before we let you go, any other sort of closing days information you want to pass on or reinforce?
Yeah, one big thing to emphasize here is we just had an important Supreme Court ruling that ballots received after Election Day in Wisconsin will not count. So if there's any more urgency we can provide to this situation, it's make sure you get those ballots in by Election Day, on Election Day, because that's the last day they'll count in Wisconsin.
And again, the recommendation, I think, from just about everybody at this point is don't assume that it's going to get there in the mail now. Drop it off in person one way or another at this point.
Yes, that's correct.
Nora, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Nora Eckert, reporter for VoteBeat, working with Wisconsin Watch. You can read more at wisconsinwatch.org. Now, a new national survey from the American Psychological Association shows that this year has been tough on the mental health of Americans, especially younger adults. The survey looked at how multiple factors have contributed to higher stress levels across many age groups. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How has your stress level been this year? Have you had ups and downs, more of one than the other? Have you found good ways to help relieve stress over the course of, say, the last 6-7 months? What works? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jenna Bame-Lawton is a psychology instructor at Madison College. We're going to talk to her a little more about the survey results and how people can find support during this time. Jenna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've got this survey out. What struck you the most when it came to our stress and anxiety levels, at least according to this survey?
I think the generational gap was pretty interesting in this. So about 8 in 10 adults say that particularly the coronavirus pandemic is a significant source of stress in their lives. And I don't think that in and of itself is very surprising, but particularly for the Generation Z, so that's the teens and early young adults out there, their stress levels seem to be higher than millennials, boomers, and older adults in terms of what they're reporting.
Well, that's interesting. And maybe they're the ones in many cases missing out on some of those early things that you expect to happen. They might have missed out on their high school graduation or particular elements of going to college, or their early job prospects are being hindered by this. So there are some pretty likely reasons, I guess, that age group would feel extra stressed.
Absolutely. A lot of the rites of passage, you know, we kind of have taken them for granted, and they've either been postponed or canceled altogether. You know, like you said, graduation, proms, just getting to see their friends one last time in high school, or the early initiation of young adult activities are really being kind of hindered by this, moving out, you know, starting a life for yourself, getting a new job, going to college, all of those things that are kind of part of what people had anticipated, you know, before the pandemic hit, now just are either not possible or they are different in a lot of ways than they used to be. And that's, I think, a huge source of stress for that age group in particular.
Can you talk about the impact of having multiple sources of stress? Because, you know, one way or another, daily life can be stressful at different points in normal times, whatever those are. Throw in a pandemic, concerns over race in the United States, a big election campaign that I think a lot of people across the political spectrum are feeling stress over. So it's not just one thing. It's these things layered on each other. How much of an impact can that have?
Absolutely. That's a huge impact. So there's several different ways of looking at stress, but one of them is a distinction between what sort of acute stress or stress that happens every day and kind of things that are transitioned very quickly away. You know, you have an argument with a roommate or you know, something goes wrong at work. Those are the kind of stressors that are typical. But I think what a lot of people are experiencing right now are these chronic stressors. They just don't let up. And that can be things, you know, like racism, obviously, is a huge stressor. And I think that, you know, that just is grinding day after day after day. Things like the election and just being hammered with all of these advertisements and phone calls and text messages. You know, if it's like if anyone's like me and they're getting text messages, you know, many times a day about the campaign, it doesn't let up. The pandemic, of course, has lasted for quite some time now, and our lives haven't gone, you know, haven't bounced back the way that they typically would after sort of more an acute stressor. So chronic stress can be a damage both to mental and physical stress. So a lot of times people will experience this because of this multi-layered stress, and it just never seems to ebb enough to kind of catch up and get back to that baseline. So people can have all kinds of physical problems, headaches and sleep problems and stomach aches and all sorts of things like that. But also mental health issues like depression and anxiety are a huge factor in this, getting triggered by the chronic stresses that people are experiencing. And our bodies and minds really weren't designed to experience these chronic stressors. And so it really kind of puts everything out of whack, including our immune system.
I think, Jenna, it's easy to think of, oh, I'm a little stressed or I feel a little anxious. You know, we can dismiss those as little things, not a big deal. Can you talk about the importance of taking it seriously, especially when there's a lot of reasons to feel stress and anxiety?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the important things to look at is how much of a dysfunction is the stress causing in your life. And it's really important to take it seriously at all levels, but particularly if you're experiencing things that are interfering with your ability to live your life or are causing thoughts that are distressing, self-harm kinds of things. It's really important in those cases to reach out. And one of the positive things on this is that more and more mental health professionals are offering telehealth, things that can be done on the phone or virtually. And those kinds of resources are in place along with, suicide prevention hotlines and other things that have been in place prior to the pandemic. But I think really noticing not only for yourself, but for others, when that takes a turn into something that's really interfering with your life, it's important to reach out. And it's okay not to be okay. Sometimes we get in this idea that it's a sign of weakness or something if we admit how hard this is, but it is hard. It's hard on everybody and particularly on the young people who may not know how to reach out or how are they supposed to get that social support that they need. So it's definitely something that we want to take seriously. And it's okay not to be okay. to need more support.
We're talking to Madison College psychology instructor Jenna Boehm-Lawton about stress and anxiety and how to manage them. And we're going to look at more ways we can help ourselves and help each other in times of stress and anxiety. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how we can manage stress and anxiety? Are you feeling it this year? Have you helped others around you? How'd that go? Are your kids feeling stressed out? Do we have some younger people who aren't coming into the adult world that they expected in 2020? How are you dealing with that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jenna Boehm-Lawton, psychology instructor at Madison College, talking about how stressed people are this year and how we can manage stress and anxiety in our daily lives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found a tried and true method for managing stress and anxiety? Exercise, maybe baking, meditation, reaching out to other people for help? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, Jenna, let's talk about the importance of maintaining our social connections, reaching out for friends and family, to them and for them. How important is it and to find ways to do that, even if we can't get together in person?
It's very important. Cultivating social support is one of the things that really can make a difference in that the stress levels that people are feeling right now. And that is more difficult than at other times because of the pandemic. So it's kind of an interesting thing that normally when we're stressed, we reach out to others and get that social support. But one of the things that actually is stressing is how isolating this can be and how the traditional methods of getting together with friends and family that we would normally do, we just don't have access to for safety reasons. So there are other ways of doing this and still getting social support. So one of the things is to make sure that you are kind of being strategic in how you access these social support services. So for example, some of your friends may be better at practical advice, some may be better at just kind of listening and sympathizing. Sometimes even giving support yourself to others can be really empowering as far as being a social support for someone. So just making sure that you're kind of keeping that in balance. And technology is certainly not perfect and in many ways is not a substitute, but there are a lot of things that it can do that make it a good way to reach out for people, not only the professionals, but also friends and family, making new friends, new activities that are either outside and socially distanced or, reaching out. Virtual happy hours have become a thing now that people do and virtual work meets. There are games you can play that are designed to be played with other players over the internet that are while you're on a Zoom call with them. So there's a lot of different ways that you can still connect with those people in your life, even if it's just a FaceTime call. And sometimes we just neglect that because, we're feeling isolated and so we forget to reach out. But it is very important to have that social support.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Rhinelander. Joe, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about, Joe?
Hey, Rob. Big fan.
Thank you.
One thing that I survived a really horrible accident and just got out of the hospital about a year ago. and got launched right into this crisis on top of it. But one thing that a piece of advice I would like to share with people is every morning when I wake up, before I put my feet on the floor, I run through the list of all the things that I'm grateful for. And there's so many people that have it much worse off. And I make sure that every time throughout the day, if I get a little frustrated, I just take a step back, I take a breath, and I go over my short list of the things I'm grateful for that I have. And I find that that has really helped me tremendously throughout this. Plus, having a good social support group, even though it may only be over the phone, but keep in contact with the people that matter with you and remind you of how good you do have it.
Joe, thank you so much for sharing your story. Best on your continued recovery. I love what he said about gratitude, Jenna, that just kind of going through and thinking about things to be grateful for as a way to, I think, relieve some of the anxiety in a really tough time for Joe.
Absolutely. Yeah, optimism and just appreciation is a great way to reframe stressful situations in your life, you know, thinking about it of the good things, like you were saying, and looking at those problems in not so much as problems, but maybe challenges. Those are all ways of reframing things. And appreciation, absolutely. Optimism has been linked with all kinds of healthy physical and mental conditions. So for example, the more optimism you have, typically the better you take care of your body, the more you exercise, better heart health, stronger immune system. All of those things are tied with optimism. So having that optimism, having that appreciation is a great way of reframing.
Thanks so much for calling in, Joe, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jenna Baim-Lawton, psychology instructor at Madison College, about a stressful time here in the United States. A lot of people feeling stress and anxiety for, you can list the reasons, your own self, but getting some advice on how to deal with that as well. Jenna, we've talked about the importance of seeking social support. Let's flip things around and talk about, okay, if I'm that position, I suspect my friend or whoever is feeling anxious or stressed, or they're coming to me to talk to me. How can I be a good listener? How can I hopefully offer them some advice, even if I'm not, you know, a professional in this kind of stuff?
Right. I think that a lot of people are going to be put in that position where people are reaching out to them to be that support system. And one of the things to do, and you mentioned it actually in your question, but just is listen. Listen instead of sometimes we want to rush in and help and say, okay, great, I'm going to help you solve this problem. And really, a lot of times what they're looking for is someone just to sympathize or empathize with them. You know, yes, this is hard. This is difficult. Sometimes they may be looking for specific support and helping them connect with resources in the community. For example, if they're having problems with, you know, getting enough food or job resources, there are food banks in the community and places that sometimes they just might need practical help in actually finding those resources and connecting to those resources. And sometimes it can feel overwhelming for people to have to look for those on their own. So sometimes that can be a support that's really beneficial. But a lot of times just listening and acknowledging how hard it is, acknowledging the sacrifices people have made. So there's a lot of people who have, you know, like we were talking about with Gen Z, are missing significant parts of their lives. I know a friend of mine had a wedding planned and it wasn't the same as it was going to be thanks to the pandemic. So, you know, lots of people have made sacrifices and they're doing this for all of us. And so kind of acknowledging that and acknowledging how hard it is, but how grateful we are for that can be another way of giving that social support.
Yeah, earlier in the year, we had a conversation about how people were inventing kind of new rituals to replace the ones mm-hmm. we lost. And even just the other day, I heard from a Lutheran minister in Door County who talked about how they'd, you know, changed the services and made them parking lot services and just found new ways to fill in the gaps for our old rituals. How important is doing stuff like that?
Very much, especially for the young people who are observing these milestones. So the temptation, and I think at the beginning of the pandemic, the temptation was to put them off until things were quote unquote normal again. So yes, we'll still have the same thing, but it'll just be delayed. But I think now we're moving more into what are some ways we can, you know, make this, reinvent this to still be meaningful for people, and that these celebrations can continue, these traditions can continue, but we have new ways of doing them rather than looking at them as you know, ruined, and this is kind of the substitute for that. How can we do this in ways that will be meaningful for people, even if they're not the way that they always were? But having those it's such an important part of people's lives, but especially the young people.
How can we build, I guess, a sense of resilience as we find these, you know, the disappointments, the canceled things that we're trying to replace with something else? How can we build up an ability to roll with the punches and recover?
Mm-hmm. I think part of that is, you know, making sure that we have the resources available, facilitating access to mental health services so that people can get the resources that they need. That may include funding for, you know, school-based things and health services that people would then have access to. But I think another way of getting to a resilience factor is in a way of kind of reframing it, is to think about longer term rather than just shorter term. So a lot of times we look around and go, oh my gosh, all of this stuff is piling up and it's happening and it's now. And that's important. But if you think about how you'll be looking at this time period in your life in a year or 10 years or 20 years, people make it through. And I think that's a really kind of source of inspiration, maybe, that Americans have made it through, and people all around the world have made it through very tough times and come out stronger and able to still make it through those times. And we can do that too. So I think all of those are really kind of important ways of building resilience factors, creating those new opportunities that we talked about with social support, those new rituals, and just kind of encouraging people to make available new opportunities for people and these new opportunities for education or work or training. I know at our college, we're coming up with innovative ways to do things in a socially distanced or online environment that we probably never would have come up with had we not been sort of forced to by the pandemic. So I think
we'll need to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Jenna Boehm-Lawton, psychology instructor at Madison College, talking about stress and anxiety in 2020 and how to deal with it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, there are a handful of races that will determine who controls the U.S. Senate. This year, they include Georgia, Maine, and a contest some are calling a Tar Heel toss-up. Jen White has those stories today at 6 on 1A+. Now, downsizing, decluttering, updating, redecorating, they're all reasons that someone would get rid of some items that are no longer useful or wanted. With the best of intentions, we often turn to thrift stores or charities when we want to get rid of things, thinking, hoping that our old items will find a second life somewhere else and that somebody else will enjoy them. Well, that is true. In some cases, our next guest found out that on average, thrift stores only sell about a third of the items they put on their shelves. Many things don't even make it to the public. Adam Minter wanted to find out what really happens to our things after we're done with them. So he spent years in the places where our cast-off items end up, from an importer of used goods in Africa to the donation center of Goodwill. Adam's latest book is called Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. He spoke with Judith Sears-Poisson earlier this year.
You got into the core issues of this book after your own mother passed away, and you and your sister needed to deal with the stuff she left behind. And I think that's really a situation so many people can relate to. What kind of thoughts were you having as you went through that process?
Well, it's sort of the second period of mourning that, you know, those of us who live in consumer societies encounter. You know, after your parent is gone or your loved one or your friend, you are left with that material legacy. These things that may have mattered to your relative, but don't necessarily matter that much to you. And we reach the end of this process of cleaning out my mother's home and cleaning stuff out of garages of relatives where she had left stuff. And we found ourselves staring at her china, saying to each other, you take it. No, you take it. No, you take it. We knew my mother loved that china. But we realized neither of us really wanted a red space for it. So we decided we'd take it to a Goodwill. And as I was waiting in line to at a donation center in Minnesota to drop it off at a drive-through donation center, it occurred to me that this might be a good subject for a book, because we are not the only people to do this. And there's, you know, there was a lineup of people there dropping off things that they probably didn't know where it was going either. So it struck me as a very personal way that people could identify with to get into the subject of what happens to all of our excess, because clearly our relatives can't handle all this stuff. So who's going to handle it?
And as we said, many of us, for a variety of reasons, end up in this situation, whether it's someone else's things that are left or our own that maybe we need to downsize, or we're spring cleaning, right, or maybe we're moving for the fifth time and we realize we've been lugging the same stuff from residence to residence. We attach value to these things, whether it's sentimental value or we think that it's quote unquote worth something, but mm-hmm. that's often pretty far from what the truth really is.
Right. And I think, you know, for me, going through this journey, not just of trying to figure out what to do with my mother's stuff, but watching what happens with all the stuff that's going through these donation doors, it was the sort of the revelation that the stuff that we have in our homes really isn't worth very much to anybody but to ourselves. You know, you may have paid $2,000 for that beautiful dining room table, but and it may have meant something to you and your family, and you have memories of Thanksgivings and all kinds of events around it. But the fact that you have sentimental value built into that doesn't mean you're going to be able to find somebody to pay $2,000 for it. Or for that matter, you may not be able to find a donation center that wants it, because there is such an excess of these beautiful tables out there right now, and they are out of fashion. And so that's where it becomes, you know, quite difficult, and you start to see how much of our identity is built around these things that that we, you know, we value so much and attach such powerful sentimental value to, but there's no correspondence to actual real value in the world, something that somebody else would buy. So it's all about what matters to you personally, but it doesn't really matter to, if you will, the market that's out there for stuff.
And one of the interesting aspects of this is tastes change, and things that were in style or in fashion and really kind of a status symbol for a generation or two ago just really don't fit in what we think of as a modern home often.
Right, exactly. And if you go, say, to any antique mall that you may have there in Wisconsin, you will find an excess of what's called in the business brown furniture. And I think we all know instinctively what that means when you say the term about brown furniture. It's just not in fashion anymore. And yet 50 years ago, people couldn't wait to get their hands on that beautiful oak furniture. And so it goes out of fashion, and suddenly people are buying things that have cleaner lines. And you have an entire antique establishment, if you will, that has to figure out where this stuff can go. And it's not just the big things, you know, like the big pieces of oak furniture. I mean, along the way of reporting this book, you know, I kept hearing about how Hummel figurines, and I think some of your listeners will certainly know what these small German porcelains look like, which, you know, would go for $300, $400 a few years ago. You're having a hard time getting $20, $30 for some of them anymore, because the people who love those things are passing on and the next generation doesn't want them. And so, again, it becomes one of these situations where the absolute value of something, the monetary value, really isn't there when the sentimental value goes away.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his book, Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And Adam, one of the aspects of your book that I found the most interesting is that in the United States, a whole industry has grown up around this issue of people needing to clean out the homes of their loved ones, either when they move to, say, a care facility or when they pass away. And it's not just people who are dealing with the stuff. They are also dealing with their relatives who are wrestling with the feeling of getting rid of things that they feel like there should be something better to do with them.
Yeah, exactly. The move management industry, which, you know, in some sense probably has existed for centuries, the idea that somebody would help you clean out your home and take the stuff with them. But it's become formalized in the last 20 and 30 years. And there's actually an association of what's called move managers. And And what they do is, yes, they'll come in and help you pack things up, but at the same time, they will sort of counsel you, you know, talk to you about your stuff, you know, especially older relatives who are very attached to the things that, you know, they've lived with for 50 or 60 years, that wedding china, you know, they may have that wedding china and several other sets of china. And so they will counsel them, literally counsel them on, you know, why this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to take with them. So I spent time with these businesses, and it can be really heartbreaking encounters that you see these move managers have, you know, with people. And it's not just in the United States either. Japan also has a similar industry, and they are facing some of the similar pressures that we have in the United States with an aging demographic that has acquired a lot of stuff through a very affluent period, and they can't take it with them, whether it means to senior housing or, you know, if they pass along, you know, they can't take it with them there either. So it's a very big industry, and it's going to grow, especially as the United States ages further, and we see these very affluent generations trying to figure out who is going to get their stuff, where it's going to go.
And it's interesting, Adam, because it's definitely not, as you just said, an American problem. This also happens in Japan, European countries, elsewhere. But one of the biggest differences, it seems, is that Americans have more room in their homes to put more stuff.
Exactly. And that's the big difference is, you know, over the last 50 years, the American house has grown by almost the average American house has grown by almost 50%. Americans have gone through a period of incredible affluence. So they've been able to buy stuff to fill up those homes with. And the price of so many goods has declined. So those homes are filling up with stuff that, you know, that may have been valued by the person who bought them. But because the price of goods has fallen, the quality of goods has fallen. And so it's less desirable, if desirable at all, to somebody else who's looking to acquire it. So you have more stuff filling bigger homes that nobody wants. And that's becoming a real problem. And it's where these move managers and other services that are out there to help people downsize become really important.
Let's go to the phones. And Mike in Madison is up. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So I am about to go deal with this situation your guest was talking about, and I was wondering if he had some options for me. Unfortunately, the past 6 months with my father's dementia, he's gone on massive spending sprees. Unfortunately, we've been able to catch a lot of it and return it, where he would buy like a microwave every day or buy things he thought he needed. And we've been able to return a lot of it, but we're finding things that he has secret stashed all over. And so I know you guys talked about giving away some of it, but unfortunately, in order to keep my stepmother in the home, we need to sell a lot of stuff. And I'm wondering if an auction is perhaps an idea, or, I guess what I'm asking is there any options for the best way to kind of recoup some of the cost? Cause he's run up almost $32,000 on credit card bills in the past 6 months.
And thanks for that call, Mike, and sorry that you're in that situation. Adam, I know you probably can't give very specific advice to Mike, but in your research, did you find some things that seem to work better for people who are in that situation where they really actually need to recoup some of the value?
Yeah, it's really hard because, you know, as anybody who's ever bought a new car knows, when you drive that new thing off the car lot, the proverbial car lot, it loses a lot of value. And so recouping value is very difficult. The one thing I would say, I mean, you know, I found myself in this position. So I, you know, it's very hard to go out there and say, I'm going to sell each and every item off. It's incredibly time consuming. And you got to measure, you know, how much your time is worth. But my advice then would be to find somebody, a clean out service, somebody who's going to go in there and take the stuff that nobody wants, as well as some of the valuable stuff, and you know, just face up to the fact you're going to take a loss on some of it.
So they'll go in, clear it out, and I think, remembering from your book, they will give you a price quote, but they will actually deduct a little bit for things that they feel that they can make some money on.
Exactly. I mean, the amount of time that goes into, say, doing an estate sale for most families isn't worth it, and they don't have enough stuff to sell in the first place. So the best option is to let somebody come in and just take the whole thing, and there'll be a fee involved, or maybe they will pay you something, but you're not going to recoup the value from everything, but at least you're going to have it off your hands.
We're listening back to a conversation with Adam Minter about his book, Secondhand Travels in the Global Garage Sale. We want to hear from you. Have you had to downsize or get rid of someone else's things? Do you frequently donate to thrift stores? How likely are you to buy items secondhand? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to a conversation with Adam Minter, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, author of the book Secondhand Travels in the Global Garage Sale. Want to hear from you. Do you shop secondhand? Do you try to buy items that can be reused or repaired? Do you focus on quality more than price, or do you tend to buy the cheapest option? And have you been faced with the job of either rehoming or disposing of a loved one's possessions? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
I want to zero in on that global garage sale part of this, Adam. How is our thrift store and stuff market in the U.S. connected to markets all over the world?
Well, intricately. And if there weren't markets all over the world for our stuff, there'd be a lot more stuff not being reused and a lot of it headed to landfills and incinerators. There's two really big areas that do go abroad and where there are markets for our stuff. The first is secondhand clothes. There's huge demand overseas for secondhand clothes from North America, and especially from the colder parts of North America. When you think about it, most of the world that's importing secondhand clothes are warm weather climates, and so they really like lightly worn summer clothes. So in Wisconsin, for example, you know, the summers are relatively short, and people don't wear their summer clothes for very long, so they tend to be in good shape when they go to donation centers. There's huge demand for that in places like Africa and Southeast Asia. The other set of, and so if it wasn't going there, a lot of it would not be going anywhere. It would be ended up in landfill. And the other area is electronics, things like computers, things like smartphones. Anybody who's traded in a smartphone recently knows that there's demand for it. There's value in it. And a lot of that value is coming from overseas where people can't afford expensive new devices, a $1,000 phone. So they're willing to go back a couple generations, spend a little less, but at least it connects them to the internet and gets them online and sort of bridges that digital gap. So again, instead of that stuff being landfilled, although it probably wouldn't be landfilled, but recycled, it's actually reused. And that's overall better for the environment. And it's also better for our closets and desk drawers because it means the stuff has somewhere to go. There's demand for it.
You do say in your book, Adam, that there's an interesting trend now that good quality clothes are actually getting less expensive, and that makes the secondhand clothing that often is of inferior quality less appealing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big shift now in the global secondhand clothing trade because East Asian manufacturing in particular has become so good at making clothing so cheaply that new clothing, especially in developing regions, is competing aggressively against secondhand clothing. And so that means that the price of secondhand clothing on the global markets and demand for secondhand clothing in developing countries is falling off. And it's happening just at a time when people in places like Japan and the United States and Canada and Europe are buying more clothes than ever. We all know about the fast fashion phenomenon, you know, people buying essentially disposable clothing that'll only last three or four washes or three or four weeks, you know, in terms of fashion cycles. And so you're actually that sort of thing combined with the drop off in demand in these developing countries means that there's more excess clothing that's going to have fewer places to go. And that's posing a real long-term structural challenge to organizations like Goodwills and Salvation Armies and other businesses that take sort of the middle market secondhand clothing.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his new book, Secondhand Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And let's go to the phones. And Jeff in West Salem is up. Hi, Jeff.
Well, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What would you like to share?
Well, I know I've since I retired, and even before that, I've been doing a little rummage sailing, you know, in the summertime. And the one thing that I've noticed is people don't, all the old timers are selling all their old tools, everything from socket wrenches to table saws and planers and joiners. And, you know, I think there's nobody that uses that stuff anymore, or very few people. And I think a lot of it probably just ends up going to the junkyard and sold as scrap prices.
And thank you for that call, Jeff. And Adam, that touches on a couple of things. You do talk specifically about tools, and also you grew up in a family of junkyard owners.
We did. I grew up in a Minneapolis, a small Minneapolis scrap metal recycling operation. And so what he says is true. I mean, as as a young person who worked in that business, I saw a lot of these old tools come in, and he's absolutely right. This isn't just a recent phenomenon. It goes back a couple decades where we would get that stuff. There's no secondhand market, at least no immediate secondhand market for that stuff. And so it would be put into the bins that were sent to steel mills or you know, whatever type of metal it was for remelting. So you would lose that stuff. It's frustrating. You know, as I traveled the world looking at this book, I did find places that really did like those beautiful old hand tools, because those tools the gentleman just called about are beautifully made. I mean, they're very durable. But folks in the States in particular are just not using that stuff anymore. But you certainly can find people in Africa, for example, in Ghana and Kenya, where I've been, and you'd see that stuff there and they'd use it. But, you know, the trick is, how do you connect the buyers and the sellers? And so often that's the real difficulty is, you know, there may be somebody in northern Ghana who would love to get their hands on those tools, but it's, you know, how do we connect that person with somebody in Wisconsin who has them? And so in many cases, because it's so difficult and so expensive to move that stuff between the people who want it and the people who have it, it ends up getting recycled, and we lose that beautiful tool forever.
And Adam, you do advocate for things like the right to repair or labeling that actually talks about what durability you can expect from that. Would those be good steps in helping us avoid some of this waste?
Absolutely. Right to repair is a great movement, and I know you've had legislation introduced in Wisconsin to do it, which is just the idea that manufacturers have to share with consumers the documentation of how to fix their stuff. You know, if you buy a phone, an iPhone, for example, today, Apple will not let you see the repair documentation. Now, very few people are going to repair their own iPhone, but there's lots of independent businesses that would love to get access to that kind of documentation so they can repair it for you. And so if you allow people to get their stuff fixed, it's going to last longer. The other item that I've advocated for, you know, sort of dealing with some of these problems is just, as you said, something called durability labeling, which is this idea which has been tested out in Europe that manufacturers should have to put a sticker, say, on something that they make, saying how long that they expect it to last. And in many cases, especially with, you know, mechanical goods, say like a washing machine, or in terms of textiles like a shirt, they can tell you how many times they expect it to last in the washer, how many cycles they expect it to last when it's washing. And that kind of thing we found in Europe has actually helped people buy better for themselves. They'll spend a little bit more to get something that's going to last a little longer. And that's ultimately the goal, because we don't want people, you know, you don't want people buying lots of disposable things. It's not good for the pocketbook, and it's not good for the environment either. So if you can get folks to be buying on their own better, more long-lasting stuff, it's gonna benefit everybody and be one step, not the only step, to dealing with this problem of houses overflowing with stuff.
It can be really hard, even when you know that there's not a market for things. Let's go back to that old China, and we had a caller that we're not going to have time to go to saying, you know, isn't there maybe a historical society or something that would take it? What, Adam, in our last minute here, would you like us all to leave this conversation with in thinking about our relationship to items and stuff?
Well, I would say two things. One, I mean, it's really long past due for people to stop investing so much of their identities in the stuff that they buy. I mean, you know, I advocate, you know, when people buy gifts for people at a wedding or whatever it is, buy experiences. You know, at this point in human history, it's probably too far along to be you know, spending our time investing so much in a set of china. You know, it's eventually going to end up, everything ends up in the trash bin eventually anyway. Very, very little stuff, you know, goes on and on and ends up in a museum, a historical society. So keep that in mind about where stuff is going to go when you buy it, because ultimately it's not going to end up in that museum. And I think when you start buying and consuming with that in mind, you're going to make better choices, and you're going to be leaving fewer messes for yourself and for your relatives.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. It was a really interesting conversation and book.
Thank you so much.
We were listening back to a conversation with Adam Minter about his book, Secondhand, Travels in the Global Garage Sale. He spoke with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson earlier this year. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate wraps up a series of interviews with candidates for Congress here in Wisconsin with a look at the 6th District, reaching from central to eastern Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, with Election Day right around the corner, we'll get opposing takes on which candidate is a better choice for Wisconsin, President Trump or former Vice President Biden. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.